final speaker, and then we're going to move on to a period in which we're going to talk about, again, what we can do about all this. And we're fortunate to have three speakers from such different backgrounds, all in different places, in Palestine, here in Canada, and in the States, and on behalf of different movements. So we're going to talk about, we're going to ask them basically what they're doing about it and what they think all of us can do about stopping what Israel is doing. So our next speaker is Muhir Hinder.
Hindi,
sorry. He's from Al-Ada. Al-Ada, which is the
Palestine Backward Coalition.
Cool.
We're trying to get this into the English dictionary, like the Intifada into the English dictionary. We want to make it a word that becomes an acronym, and that is actually the return. So that's why we chose to pick an Arabic name, but we always explain what it is. So I will write it down if you want, because that's our main focus.
So again, that's the Palestine Right of Return Coalition. He's the co-chair of the Canadian branch of that. He's come from Toronto, and we have about 10 to 20 minutes to...
Okay.
And then we'll get into a question period.
I was told that I should gear my discussion more towards activism or tips around organization. But at the same time, what I really wanted initially to talk about is how is Oslo, whatever has happened in the past 10 years, is part of actually the neoliberal attack on the world. And I think even when we talk about this, we would be talking about what are the best ways to work collectively around the Palestinian issue through that perspective. I will start just to say that prior to Oslo, 200,000 Palestinian workers used to work in Israel, and not one of them turned into a suicide bomb. What we have now is we don't have workers in Israel because they're not allowed to go in, and we have more suicide bombers. Now, this is not to go into the discussion of suicide bombing, but mainly to draw attention between the socioeconomic factors that go into any kind of conflict. And when we talk about workers in Palestinian workers in Israel, it's not about the generosity of Israel of letting Palestinian workers work in Israel. As per Geneva's Forest Convention, Article 40, it's a right to work for any occupied people. Actually, any occupying force has to grant its workplace for the occupants and even apply those its laws on Israeli, let's say, workers, also on Palestinian workers. So the right to work in Israel is actually an international right, and we want to make this clear because we were celebrating May Day 2 weeks back. Anyhow, why is this analysis so important? Because for us, I think it can draw and help in organizing across a wider and broader activist levels. So if you're working, if you're talking about the neoliberal attack on or globalization on Colombia or Afghanistan, the Palestinian issue is directly the same. We work with the Filipino Solidarity Group, with the Colombian Solidarity Group, anti-war movements, not because it's a marketing tactic, because this is exactly the same struggle for us. And whenever we are working for Palestine, we're working for Colombia. And whatever tactics we develop for this struggle is the same that can be implemented. So we saw so many workshops that has been focused on Colombia, Palestine, X, Y, and Z. And we haven't seen a single workshop that talks mainly about activism. And what we want to say mainly here is these are all joined struggles, and you should work in all of them for one fight of globalization, and this is one. Now, I will go into why Oslo is similar to, let's say, the Colombian issue. Now, in globalization, there's always a local partner, and here I'll be direct and straightforward. Palestinian Authority is a direct partner in the globalization issue when it comes to Palestine. And so many people talk about Oslo Accord. Well, it was followed by something called the Paris Agreement in 1994. And this was the economic side of Oslo Agreement. Actually, the Palestinian Authority, or PLO, adopted completely neoliberalism. Okay? So when people talk about Camp David II or previously Oslo and why land was so dissected, it's actually because geopolitics became irrelevant. Land became irrelevant. It was mainly about economic partnership and capital moving into or abusing the Palestinian issue. And people say, okay, the Mexican president was a Coca-Cola employee. The Afghani now interim president is also an ex-American oil. Arafat is an employee. Of course, he's not an employee, but somehow, for some reason, they thought that this will benefit the Palestinian people by allowing the global capital to go into the Palestinian authorities, where we don't see what's the connection. The Palestinian Accord, or the Paris, the Paris Accord was actually dictated by the IMF. It mainly stated open market, global capital going in, opening in it to banking that would work only on that basis. No economic plan for any local infrastructure. And it also talked about coming up with six industrial zones, which actually Nizar talked about one. These six industrial zones are along the green line, which actually separates the West Bank. I don't know what's green about it. It separates the West Bank from Israel. So now when we're talking about the new roads that dissect whether Gaza or West Bank, well, actually no one is interested in internal movement. People are interested in moving labor from these Bantustans to the six industrial areas. And these are the areas where the global capital will come in and erect maybe, I don't know what, a Nike maybe factory where Palestinian labor is an hourly wage labor. And instead of them going inside Israel to work, they will mainly be focused in these areas. That's Oslo. That's Paris Accord, you know. And with the PA adopting that and not having any economic plan, how was the PA supposed to survive? The initial grants were around $4 billion. It was given to the PA. But also the focus was, you know, that you are going to get taxes through income taxes of Palestinian workers. Now, initially, the Palestinian workers were going to Israel. Then Israel started to pressure the Palestinian Authority by blocking Palestinian workers from going to Israel. What would that deprive PA from? The income tax. So what happened was actually that the PA, which mainly compromises from those activists that were outside who came later to the territories to manage the territories, they had to become the new monopolizers of the economy and create the income needed for the survival. So they replaced the existing middle class traders that were always existing for and actually destroying them by creating 15 new monopolies over cigarette, over sugar, over oil, over whatever you want. 15 monopolies of, and they became the, that was the source of income. Why did PA want such an income? Because they have created a workforce of 100,000, mainly security. The highest rate of security per person was in West Bank and Gaza. And the other civil comprador that was needed for political, you know, we're selling you Singapore here. Paris is Singapore. That's what we were told. Palestine is going to become Singapore of the Middle East. So you had to buy this political power by employing people, giving these salaries, 100,000 employees, whether security or other civil servants. Now, later, Israel started to press the granting countries to send the money. So these monopolies had to be created for the survival of the Palestinian Authority, who was destroyed, the middle class, the Palestinian middle class. How does the middle class work or survive or even try to evolve? Banks? Okay. Israeli laws before Oslo used to have a 3 to 6 years of kind of, I'm not here, by the way, saying thank you to the Israeli banks, but had better conditions than later rules by PA for banks. The ratio of loans to deposits after Oslo in the banks were 17%, comparing to Jordan, 70%, comparing to Israel, 90%. That is the banks weren't giving out loans. The average, I'm saying here, the ratio of loans out to the deposits in the banks. What does this destroy? Are there any opportunities for the local economy? So this destroys the fabric and even the backbone of any, whether civil or social, resistance for occupation. And to that, I would say that this was also prior Oslo by confiscating land, confiscating 60% of West Bank. Palestinian people, even before, were peasants and farmers. And when we're talking about these issues, I would actually go back to 1948, when the biggest diaspora happened. The farmers in the coastal areas, who were mainly workers or owners of orange groves, when they left their products. And the United Nations had a committee called the Reconciliation Committee that was actually disbanded in 1964. Imagine the United Nations was working since 1948 till 1964 on the refugee issues. And only in 1964 is disbanded this effort. So when we're saying we're working for refugees' right of return, it's right, because that was for more than 20 years adopted by United Nations. The first concern of that Reconciliation Committee was to allow the refugees to come back and save their products for the first 6 months after 1948. That was what they were saying, allow the refugees. These refugees don't need United Nations money. They were producers. They were surviving on their products. So I just wanted to bring this point to tell you that refugees, once they're back, they're able to survive economically without globalization. Similarly, when Israel occupied West Bank, it took 60% of the land. What does that do? That deprives the local force from their workspace, their farmers. More damage, women, Palestinian women, work in the, along their husbands in the farms. Now Palestinian women don't have any workplace. They're home. They can't go and work in Tel Aviv or in settlements, neither ethically nor security-wise, you know. They can't work very far from home, very far from their children. That's what we're saying when you discuss socioeconomics and how the social fabric gets destroyed. That's how resistance gets destroyed. And we have to get this perspective into our understanding of the struggle, because that's why how we get more allies into our struggle. And that's how we relate to Colombia. In Colombia, the same thing. 60% of land has been transformed into different projects rather than producing food for the people. The direct relationship is there. Okay, so let me see what else I needed to talk to. Before 1967, industrial workforce, industrial, that is needed for development of countries, was 22,000 in West Bank. After 30 years, less than 10,000. So that's another indication of how bad the situation has been, and how, even when you see this, how in the planning of the IMF through the PA, this was completely neglected, you know? No loans to middle class, only allow the global capital to come in. That's IMF, that's globalization. Other also than the 60% land in West Bank, if you see Gaza Strip, it's actually 4,000 or 7,000 settlers, I don't know the exact number, taking 40% of the land. But if you look, actually, it's half the coastal areas. Why? Gaza is adjacent to the desert, okay, the Naqab desert. So the main areas are actually either the shorelines for production, that's fisheries, and the small areas that are used for plantation. That these areas were confiscated for socioeconomic factors. Gaza people actually used to survive on fish. When you take the shorelines, where are these fisheries, fishermen going to fish? The economic damage per day is 500,000 of fish by taking half the shorelines, you know? So no one talks about these effects, how the socioeconomic fabric is being destroyed. And another thing that is relevant also is the issue of Jerusalem and Hebron. What's the debate? Religiously, who does it belong to? Hebron, does it belong to the Jews or the Muslims or Bethlehem Christians or even Jerusalem? You know, why don't you see them as big population centers? When you destroy Hebron into two halves, the major center of economic for Palestinians, and centers of big populations are always the area, the space where culture, political movements and economic events take place. Is there any now happening in Hebron with dividing it into H1 and H2? No. So it's not a matter of religious. Jerusalem, the same thing. 300,000 Arabs. If we go on around like religious issues, that is, that's what they're talking like. Jerusalem, the Arabs want it because it's, go to Kaaba. Kaaba is your religious style. It's not about this. It's about people. It's about big centers of Arab population. You destroy this, you destroy the fabric of resistance and culture. And these are things that we should adopt and go on and talk about. That's how we can get people and not alienate others from our struggles. We have to get more people into our struggles and talk to them analytically and scientifically about our struggles. Now, I will jump immediately towards what I was told to concentrate on activism and these issues. We're a small group. Al-Awda started in 2000. 30 people converged from all over North America to Boston, because then negotiations were definitely going towards denying the right of return of refugees. When we talk about refugees, we're talking about every Palestinian. Every Palestinian is a refugee. And actually, Arafat himself said why I couldn't sign Camp David, because now there are groups that are pressuring me, whether it's Al-Awda, Low, Badil, different groups, not a single group, but different grassroots groups. We decided to converge to Boston, 30 people, I wasn't them, converged to Boston and said, we have to work on this issue, the right of return. Now, some people accuse us, why right of return? You're being too specific. You have narrowed down the complete struggle from a national liberation, from the issue of, into right of return. Well, first, it involves every Palestinian. The right of return is an individual right. People don't understand that. It's like your right to vote. Can Canada go and negotiate your right to vote? No, it's an individual right. So once we go around and educate people about individual rights, such as the right to work, the right to return, which not only depends on United Nations resolutions, but also on Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 13, everyone has the right to leave and come back to his country. So once we do that, and even we have to do a much kind of education inside our Palestinian community, then everyone would develop this as his own right. So that's what creates a vertical mass movement. We shouldn't rely on our leadership to fight for us. Either we are there to remind them of our right and to support them in saying, you know, this is a mass movement. These are individual people who are fighting for their own rights. So we're not narrowing down the struggle. We're trying to create a mass movement on the understanding of everyone of his single right. And now I can tell you we have chapters in Hong Kong, in Japan. Next week we're meeting. If you go to our website, which I corrected, actually this is not the right URL, we have more than 8 websites now. We have a chapter in UK, in Paris. We have a Spanish website. In France, Hong Kong, Japan, worldwide, more than thousands are on our email lists. One way we have found that is good is actually open the door for everyone. We have more than 139 groups. That mainly tries to focus on accepting diversity. People work on groups of interest. Let's say what we've been trying to accomplish here and how we address issues in Canada. Last year we bugged the Green Party. And let me talk, let's say, why did we target them? Everyone thinks that, let's say, Israel turned the desert into a paradise, green. And the Green Party, by the way, in the U.S. is our biggest ally. But in Canada, the Green Party has decided to completely neglect the Palestinian issue. And when we finally got to meet with them, they said, well, you know, they were misinformed. Israel has, you know, environmentally is good, you know. Nakab Desert, they changed it into green. Well, I had to remind them that changing an economic system is a crime, is an economic crime. You can't change a desert. The desert there has survived there for, and has a reason to be there, has its own populations of animals and whatever. So in that way, we have targeted people who are interested in environment and told them, you know, you have to adopt this. You have to go and study these things. We can't be specialized in anything. So we create groups of interest. This group has been mainly bugging the Green Party, so far to no avail, but we have to be there. Another thing, let's see.
They also did it, taking all the water from Palestine.
Yeah, other than the water also. Yeah, there's something called environmental discrimination. When you take the water of West Bank and give it only to settlements, that's environmental discrimination. Environment is a wide issue and needs specialists. That's why we try to encourage people along this line to pick up the Palestinian struggle. Let's say another issue. Any event that takes place in Palestine can be addressed to a specific group. Let's say the occupation is so ugly in a way and is so hard. You've seen so many workshops, but you will still feel that there's so much to be talked about the Israeli occupation. Why don't we break down the occupation into different things? Let's say, in any event, you can address it in a different way. Last year, they killed Dr. Thabit Thabit, who was a Fatah member, but he was a peace activist. He worked for years along with many Israeli peace activists. He had huge recognition in Israeli peace activist groups. And he was killed, and here the media portrayed him as a terrorist. You know, he was a Fatah member. He was a doctor, he was a dentist. So when such thing happens, do I send a letter to Bill Graham? No, it's not to no avail, you know. Okay, who might be interested in such thing? The Canadian Dentist Association. So prepare the information about that. Tell them, this is a fellow dentist, this is a medical worker. Other than him, there's a history of targeting medical people. You need more information, X, Y, Z. You need even Israeli information, X, Y, Z, on the medical stuff. For that information, in a month, they were advocates for Palestine. Now, every now and then they send... So now I've created the opportunity for... Not I, Al-Audi has created the opportunity and got this group who would think of Dentist Association. Every incident, just think of who's the counterpart who might be interested in this specific issue. Occupation is so hard. We activists can't understand political things. But other groups along the different fabrics in Canada need specific issues to be interested in. So sometimes try to see what might be relevant in a way. I think, how am I going on time? Okay, should be wrapping up. Okay, so this is what we do. We work with as broad spectrum of groups as possible, not because it's a marketing tactic, because it's a must. The whole world is going across through a globalization attack. Palestine is part of it because of the huge population that is going to be transformed into a labor force. Maxim Rodelson defined that in 1967. His book is as valid then as now. But colonization can reshape itself in different things. It might look, so many Palestinians argue globalization is good. It's no good. And that's our analysis for the Intifada as well. Not as Al-Audi, let's say, but that's some groups' analysis. There are so many groups I can put down their names who have such an analysis. And I think we've seen also a workshop yesterday around divestment, which is important. And along this kind of analysis, why it's relevant is because what I said initially, why were these Bantustans, this model, agreed? Even, let's say, if Arafat rejected Camp David too, well, actually, you've accepted it before in Oslo. In a way, I don't understand that. In a way, you have accepted that before. Now you rejected that. I agree and around the whole concept of why to not accept that. But in a way, land has become irrelevant in globalization. And Israel now survives on dot-coms. You know, when they confiscate 60% of land, they don't go and cultivate it. When they uproot olive trees, they are actually denying themselves of that product. If they want the land, they should want the agriculture on that. So when they uproot more than 100,000 olive trees, or I don't know what the exact number is, doesn't make sense to me. If they want the land, they should want the trees. Because they're not interested, globalization isn't interested in any eco-environment-friendly industry or anything like that, or working on indigenous industries or preserving these economies. They now survive on dot-coms that only survive on capital. Divestment is part of that, getting that capital not to invest in Israel. So with that thing, I will wrap up. And thank you very much for your time.